Hello, I'm Jeremy Rivera, your unscripted SEO podcast host. I'm here with Ernesto Ortiz of Structural SEO. Give a quick introduction to yourself and your skills, and tell us why we should trust you as an SEO expert.
Ooh, that's a good question. I got into SEO full time like 5 years ago. And I come from an engineering background. I know how to code, so that was quite helpful. And I started in-house. So I got to spend a lot of time on one website, just looking at the search results every day. And meanwhile, I was learning, I was trying to figure out what was true and what wasn't, because there's just so much information out there and a lot of it is conflicting. Yes. So I end up doing tests. So I ended up setting up domains to do single variable tests. And then I tested other things on those domains and also on the main website that I was working on, with permission, of course, because I was testing. And I, over time, a combination of finding people that I think are worth listening to and also discovering things that work through these tests, I ended up with a bag of things that just moved the needle, and that's why I use them. Now I have an agency. We work mostly with e-com clients in Australia and the US, some in the UK. And we have like a month-to-month contract where they can cancel anytime. So whatever I'm implementing, I know it works because it's in my own benefit that it works. If not, I get fired. So yeah, I guess it's just out of testing and understanding what's working, and that's all.
Is there a particular reason you've leaned towards e-com? Is that close to where your original experience at was, the original site? Or was it when you started looking for clients that you ended up, oh, hey, I've got an e-com. Oh, hey, I have another e-com. Oh, hey, I did e-com, and now I've got four e-com.
Yeah, it started as an e-com. So the first business was, it was interesting. It had a B2B part and a B2C part. So it was pretty weird. And it was e-com. And it was high-ticket e-com. So products that were $1,000, I think $750 was the cheapest one, which we didn't really sell that much. The average was like $2,000. And I think we were the first, maybe even in the world, to try to sell a thing called an operable wall, which is like this massive acoustically sealed walls that you put like in auditoriums and schools and things like that, that cost like tens of thousands of dollars. We had an e-com product. Everyone else has like submit contact form and whatever. And we had an e-com product. So
that's crazy. I have a precast concrete wall client. So imagining trying to sell a wall on e-com, that's an interesting challenge. And I also like that variable of both B2B and B2C. What's been your experience on the optimization side of approaching those two halves of the coin?
I think it's the same. B2B marketing is like, when you go direct to consumer, you're at the cutting edge of everything, because people like consumer stuff, you're using the best marketing tactics or the best approaches there are to convince a human to buy your product in a sea of similar things. Yeah. B2B, I find, is like this world that lived like 10 years ago, and it's sort of catching up. So you sort of show up and give the clarity that a D2C brand has, and the experience that the D2C brand has, and you just stand out a lot. And this doesn't mean that they'll check out the same. They'll still have this internal process and whatever, but the confidence they have going into it, they've already solved all their questions. They're pretty much solved. They just want to know the last details.
That makes sense. So if you treat B2B with the same courtesy and depth, because I've fought in tooth and nail, low dollar e-commerce situations, and you have to fight and scrap for every extra ounce of clarity and firepower and detail and grit, better pictures, more clarity on the shipping processes, and all of those things have to be checked out. But it's crazy because how many B2B situations where they're just like, yeah, I guess they'll figure out that they need to get a specific PDF download to be able to order this because they need approval from their director, financial person, or XY document. It's almost like companies that are B2B are just like, yeah, I guess you'll figure it out and pay us at some point.
They have this corporate language that means nothing. It explains nothing. It clarifies nothing. Then you have to submit a contact form to the void. You get some sort of response. I don't know. It's just so much friction. And why don't you just put things up front as they are?
That's what I often wonder, you know. It's like why do you just make it? It's like you don't want to make money. It drives me as crazy as business to business sites or SaaS who don't put prices on pages. They're like, oh. It's secret information. My competitors will know how much I'm charging. Yeah, your competitors will know because the market will know, because your clients know, and they're going to pay for you if your price and service meet that. Like, it's your pricing isn't a secret weapon. It's a upfront weapon. You're just adding friction to your entire process because you're trying to obfuscate how much this thing costs because you think your competitors are going to play games with their pricing, and they probably will. But at the end of the day, if your value offer is better than your competitors for that price, then, you know, that's what you're shooting for, right?
I think if your competitors know about you, they already know your price. If you're worried about putting up one price because you have, it really depends on the engagement, what you're going to do, you can have ranges. There's always a way to clarify something in a better way than usually how it's currently being done.
So having come into SEO 5 years ago, I've been doing this 20 years. And so yes. I'm curious if you think that there's an advantage to having jumped in this quadrant of time where ChatGPT and LLM tools and rich snippets are already a thing. That's part of baked into your reality versus having, you know, a longer term view of where search has been, you know. I've literally been doing this four times longer than you, and so I have four times as much experience, but I've had four times as much change. SEO has died four times already. You've only experienced SEO dying one time so far.
I don't know. It dies every year, so maybe it's died 20 times for you. But.
Yeah, we could say it's died every year and come back, and then it's died again. So, but I've had that occur four times as more. What's your perspective as coming in from an engineering background and looking at that of like, this is the world and how I should approach it as far as SEO goes?
I think there are advantages and disadvantages. It's very easy, the longer you stay in any particular field, to get stuck in your own ways, and it's harder to change and evolve. So I think that is the disadvantage of people that have been doing it for a long time, and it's purely based on personality and if they still have this passion and effort to keep on learning and being on the cutting edge and not defaulting to what has worked for a long time for them, because it has worked for them. That's the disadvantage I think that people have. The advantage that people that spend a long time in an industry is they have seen things come and go, and they smell things easier than people who are new to the industry. Like, I don't know how many people understand that pumping all this crazy unsupervised automatic AI content might backfire in a really hard way because they've never seen it happen before. But you've seen a version of this, not the same thing, but a different version of it. So you're way more cautious. And if you're working with a business that is a brand that's been built not to be burnt, to last, you're going to take different decisions that maybe compromise a short-term gain, but will ensure the longevity of that business. So you've got to be really careful about those things. You've seen more. And what I've done is I've tried to look back as much as possible to be as informed as I can. I don't have those emotions. Like, I don't have the feeling of the person who was running all their clients, ranking them based on PBNs, and then the next day that disappeared and all their clients disappeared. The phone was ringing. What's going on? I don't have that emotion, but I do know it happened. So I try to bake it in my decision making. So there's advantages and disadvantages, because there are new things that I'm like, okay, this thing, it's easy for me to go into that straight away because I don't have to leave too much behind. But that disadvantage is I have to somehow try to catch up on that experience that I just wasn't around.
That makes sense. Chris Tweeten of a Spacebar Collective posted on Twitter. He said, experienced SEOs enjoy when a new algorithm update releases, if not for the schadenfreude, but also for the new change to the game. Do you agree or disagree?
I don't care too much about algorithm updates in the sense that the way that I understand it is most of the time what happens is a change in weight of importance of factors. So let's say you have many factors and they're just turning the dials, what's more important and what's less. When you get affected by those in a negative way, it's because you're incomplete. You optimized for the set of factors that were currently tuned up. When they changed the dials, now that might have exposed things you didn't have. So you had an incomplete optimization. But as you work on a website and you sort of know, okay, diversity of factors is a big thing, and you have a more complete situation going on, usually what happens is if you're not already in the best positions, you stay there. Nothing happens really, not that much. Unless the search intent changed, meaning the words, Google understands them as a different thing and you need to adapt because users expect something different. But if it's purely algorithmic, either you go up or you have no change. You don't go down because you don't have an incomplete situation. So I'm not too fussed about it really. And I know what's going to happen if I'm working up, it should go up. If it went down, I made a mistake, but not a big deal.
Matt Brooks of SEOteric said that ChatGPT is your most popular but least trained customer support representative. Now, using ChatGPT as a loose proxy for all of the LLM-based tools, do you think that's true? And to what degree do you cater to that reality by changing your marketing strategy?
Okay, so there's two parts to that question. I personally do not rely on these models for expertise. Like, I will use them for tell me where the gaps are. They're quite good at finding what's not there, but I won't rely on them to tell me what to do, like, at all. If I want them to consider something in a specific way, I feed them what I know and try to see if they say something that I like, that I find interesting or helpful, that points me in a different direction based on that. But from an expertise point of view, like, I don't rely on them. Now, about the part of changing the marketing strategy because they exist and they are a channel, they seem to have a big percentage of search, meaning there's just a lot of people using them.
Yeah.
I don't think you have to throw away all the rest. I do think it's helpful to look, what are the specific things that weren't a priority before that might be a priority now that seem to move the needle in this thing? This is all quite, we're not quite sure really. And out of those things that seem to move the needle, grabs the ones that you think aren't going to burn the business in 6 months, and then see if those apply to your situation and consider applying them if the client or the business is interested in tapping into this channel. But for example, it works extremely well to have a PBN, 100 articles, all listicles, saying that you are the best at something. You show up in ChatGPT in about less than a week or something. AI reviews way less. You get mentioned as the best, like recommended, not just like the recommendation that it gives, one of three or whatever. That's you if you do that. It's so easy to kill though. Maybe it's not that easy, but I don't know, man. It's a massive footprint and it's not a link. It's just a mention. You're just being mentioned. So there's no link. There's no link to target. But I find that if this becomes a widespread tactic, it's so easy to kill it. And then I don't know what happens.
Right.
So would I do that? Would I change my marketing strategy and just do that, which costs $50 or something? Like, I don't know. I don't know, man. I wouldn't do it.
Glenn Gabe was talking about that on Blue Sky earlier, of if you think that Google isn't aware that their answer engine is producing results that are based off of placements of listicles, I think you don't understand their priorities. So they are aware. It's just a question of which dials are they going to turn to adjust that? Or is that, you know, because it's Google has one of those tools, you know, they've got Gemini and that powers AI overviews. And so that's the part that I'm kind of concerned about most. Like, I'm not super scared. I know that at some point, you know, ChatGPT, Anthropic, and others will need to find a additional layer of authority to bake into the process to make gamification more difficult. And, you know, if they can, you know, we've seen the progression of AI capability in, what's the classic example, Will Smith eating spaghetti, going from, you know, a glitched out monster to literally a cinematic scene between him and his son sitting on the roof sharing a plate of spaghetti, having a normal conversation back and forth with alternate camera angles. If that level of advancement has come on that side, you know, I think at some point on the internal side, you know, these things that are easy now will become more difficult. It's just a question of when, not if. But also, you know, it's a risk proposition then of like, hey, do I also join the trend of doing this relatively cheap, affordable, easy thing to get citation visibility very quickly by putting out a bunch of listicles, even though I know long term that's going to be burned to some degree. Maybe entirely, maybe root and branch, and maybe systemically, and have a bigger negative impact. But since, you know, it doesn't involve backlinks, is a citation campaign and placement of your brand in multiple places online actually even technically against Google guidelines? That wouldn't seem to be, because, you know, on the surface, it's not a link scheme. And, you know, you're getting genuine placements in a bunch of places and you're mentioning the brand. It just happens that now, you know, those unlinked citations are having as much impact as, what are they going to tell you? We don't appreciate you finding more ways to get visibility for your brand. That kind of runs counter to Google's, you know, messaging, right? Of, hey, your brand's valuable, get it out there.
It's hard to believe Google's messaging, though, because on one hand, their AI team is use AI to do everything. And then the Google team is like, but there's stuff you can't do. So they've got conflicting messages.
The truth.
Another point is guidelines update.
True.
They're not static. Another point is I talked to Pedro Diaz.
I love Pedro.
He used to work in the Google search quality team. I just did a 2-hour podcast with him. Awesome. And the first hour is all about spam and how Google understands spam and how they go about it. And one of the things that I took out of that conversation was that they only look into things that have a scale that makes it worth doing. Because I was asking, how come lorem ipsum pages still rank? Mm-hmm. How come the casino industry does what it does? And he was sort of saying, well, on one hand, if it's not enough, we're not looking into it because it doesn't impact a lot of people. It might work on low search volume terms in obscure places. People don't see it, so we don't care. And on the other hand, like the casino side, he was like, if we take manual actions or something like that, there's going to be 100 more people to show up, so it's pointless. So if this becomes a widespread thing and the intent is to clearly, it only has a manipulation intent, they will do something about it. It's just a matter if it gets to the scale for them to do something about it, and then how easy it is to correct that within the model, which the engineers that built this model sometimes aren't even sure how they work, so, or why they do things. I don't know.
That's a fair point. I was talking with Timothy Malmros, who's kind of, he retired from the casino and gambling game, and now he's kind of a freelance black hat journalist, like exposing the newest techniques. And his current thing is about canonical bombs, people buying new domains, dumping an insane amount of links to it, and then canonicaling that to their target destination. And he's like, it's ugly and it works. It's just a question of when it becomes a large enough scale of a problem to Google for them to address it.
Yeah, it's very expensive, but like for them to address it. But going back to maybe the original question, the way that I go about these things is, do you find this risky? And would you bet your own business, the future of your business, on this tactic? And that's a question that's super personal to every client and to every person. And most legit businesses will say, nah, we don't do that because we want to ensure we stay around. We don't want to go there. So that's how I look at it. You really have to decide if you're going to be like sort of black hat or whatever other hat that works. Because black hat, you know you're going to get burnt. You do it quickly, you profit from it, and you don't care what happens. But you don't do that with a business that's real and legit.
Yeah. True. Turning to the other side of the way that things have changed in content marketing, and this may be a little bit more from my longer experience of, you know, from 2010 to 2020, the game was, hey, create as much top of funnel content as possible. You're going to get a bunch of people clicking around, and hopefully they'll move. The theory is they'll move further down the funnel. And then once they do that, then you have better chances to capture them and then convert with AI overviews, with Claude, Gemini, Copilot, and other LLMs, basically sitting at the snack bar of top of funnel query space. That necessarily has driven more content teams to finally actually address that bottom of funnel area. Of what are our market differentiators, you know, when it comes down to not what is a home renovation, but how is our home renovation in this area unique or different? Or, you know, in the SaaS space, you know, talking about that differentiation. Is that a blessing or a curse that we now, you know, a lot of our lunch has been eaten by LLM tools. Now the serious people are coming down, but it's kind of a black box again. Like, we don't necessarily know within Claude or these LLM tools, or the mix of them, or AI overviews, how many no-click searches were done. I know that I have publishing sites, radios. I work with a large radio network, and a huge amount of their content, their traffic, has been consumed and reduced. And we look at the SERPs and the outcomes, and, you know, like, almost 3/4 of their articles they write then get gobbled up in that attention economy. And so publishers are hugely hit. But I'm guessing, you know, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if they came through your top of funnel content or whether they went through LLMs, but if they're hitting a page to understand the difference in your pricing versus your competitor, you have the same opportunity to better address them at the bottom of the funnel. Is that the best way to think of that change?
I think publishers have a very specific issue that it's their business model. When you want to, like, I understand the conversation around top of funnel and bottom of funnel, but it annoys me a little bit, just because maybe it's just the way that I am, or maybe it's the way where I started. But when you work for a business, the only goal of that business is to make more money.
Sure.
So from day one, I always reviewed, am I doing this to make more money? Yes or no? And writing an information piece, like when I got in, HubSpot model was still the dominant thing you had to do. But I was like, okay, I might get to all those topics, but I first need to start with all the things that I'm selling. Like, I need to have all my product pages, all my category pages. I need to have everything that people want to know about buying this thing. And then when I'm done with that, if I'm done with that, I can go and write about this information thing to hope to get them in this buying journey cycle thing. So the fact that I think I've always been doing bottom of funnel SEO. I've never gone to the other part. And the fact that everyone's complaining about it now is just because I think their graphs look bad, and usually high-level marketing people just want to see something pretty going up to the right, and that's what has them scared. But if you sell a product, if you have a service, are you actually losing sales, or are you just losing traffic? Like, what's happening to revenue per session? Like, people still need to go and buy your thing. Yeah. It's irrelevant if they read your article or if the AI gave you the answer. You want them to go and buy your thing. So I wouldn't worry about traffic. And that's a mind shift that people that hire us need to have. It's like, traffic is irrelevant, and it always has. You've used it as a proxy for so long. That's a different thing. But you got to have better metrics, and you need to have a clear way to evaluate business results. And that's the problem with publishers, maybe, is their whole business model depended on people spending time on a page they published, so they clicked on the ad. And now they're not going to that page because they're not selling something. They don't have any valuable thing to offer beyond the information. The way they monetize was through the ads, but people don't care about that, right? So If they get the information elsewhere, why would they go there? So it's a business model challenge, and they're in such a complicated position, because if the hard truth is, if people aren't clicking through to the website, is because their expectation got resolved at the chat level. Like, people are not stupid. Like, they really don't have a reason to go. So those guys really need to give them a reason to go. And having the possibility of clicking on an ad that's following you around the internet isn't a good one. They need to want to read your piece. They need to want to read your point of view. They have to be better. I think they got away too long with just vanilla stuff.
What does that mean for agency owners like you and having that conversation with a client of, hey, you know, this chart isn't going to go up and to the right, but what does that mean for, you know, your choice of reporting stack, like the tool that you choose or how you draft or create reports? Is it more about the narrative that you build in it? What are the metrics and the KPIs? What does that conversation look like now being an agency owner and trying to convince somebody, hey, hire us? It used to be, hey, hire us, we'll increase rankings, which will increase traffic, which will increase revenue. If the activity that you're doing can't reach that same scale of increasing rankings means this much traffic, means this much revenue, there's a black box effect of, hey, I'm going to do these things to improve your visibility all over the place, and we're going to skip the messy middle part and just look at the revenue change. Does that work? Or is a demand still there of KPIs from those C-suites, those CMOs, CFOs demanding, okay, which of these numbers are you moving to ultimately move revenue?
Yeah, so that's the right way to look at it, just what you just said there. So, the right way, this is just the way that I do it. So I don't know if it's the right way or not, but we as SEOs are not responsible for revenue. Revenue depends on seasonality, market conditions. Are people buying or not? They depend on the product that you offer, how good it is, the value proposition, your brand. It depends on many, many, many things, not just having good rankings. It helps, but no advertising of any type, whether organic or paid, is going to fix a business that doesn't have a good product or service and a good value proposition. So we are not 100% responsible for revenue. We do aim to improve it.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that I do it is I do report on revenue and say, this is what happened this month. But I also say, I also report on the pure SEO metrics that I think are valuable. So for example, I report branded versus non-brand traffic. Is non-brand traffic growing or not? Those are people looking for your products and services that aren't aware of your brand. If that's growing, I have better visibility. But it's not any non-brand traffic. It's non-brand traffic to category pages, non-brand traffic to product pages. How does it change between category or product pages? So non-brand traffic on pages that matter, not non-brand traffic on blog pages about who knows what. I don't care about that. The only reason the blog pages exist is for the products and collection pages to rank higher. I don't care about that. I don't care how they're doing. I just care how they're doing, because if they do well, the internal linking is going to help to rank the collection and product pages higher. So if I report non-brand traffic on collection and product pages, I can say that my efforts are bringing qualified people to qualified pages that would make sense that they would affect revenue in a positive way. Because then you have the attribution issue where it's like, Google Ads is claiming everything, Meta Ads is claiming everything. You've got this direct black hole in Google Analytics. Like, I don't know. Like, if you see the organic revenue going up in analytics, it's going up way more because everything else is stealing from it.
Yeah.
But so you try to do it that way, and then you compare non-brand traffic with brand traffic. Is brand traffic going down? Is brand traffic staying somewhat the same? or is it growing exponentially? And that might give you a different insight. If a business has like the whole marketing team, the end result is people search the brand name. They've seen many ads. They're ready to buy. Maybe they don't click an ad. They'll search the brand name and go and do the purchase. And it's going to come through attributed through Google search branded traffic. Homepage. When you look at that and you see that's not growing, but then you take away all the revenue that came directly through the homepage and that's growing, it's very clear that your effort is working. So it's about showing that what you're doing is affecting key parts of the visibility and trying to match it up with what's going on the revenue side. It explains a lot. Sometimes the revenue isn't going up, but your metrics in the right places are going up. And you can sort of wash your hands and say, but I don't know, man, I'm getting better visibility where it matters. So they're not buying for another reason. Let's work on your user experience. Let's work on something else that might be on your conversion rate. There might be something else getting in the way between that traffic and the revenue. I know it's qualified traffic.
Or it could be seasonality.
But then you look at previous year's performance and stuff like that.
Yeah, definitely. What's the biggest pitfall that's easiest to avoid right now as an SEO?
Easiest pitfall to avoid. The LinkedIn posts about DM whatever and you'll get the system and run that on your site and who knows what's going to happen if you even get the system. Yeah, just I think AI has a massive capability. Like we use it a lot. It helps in productivity and all that, but not the way they claim it does, and not how they actually sell it to you or offer it. Like, yeah, that's the biggest pitfall. Just don't get overwhelmed by that nonsense.
So avoid the shiny object syndrome, the pitches of doing XYZ from XYZ experts on LinkedIn claiming, 1,000% success.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, have they ever ranked a website before? Like, did they know writing was a thing a year ago? Like, I don't know. Like, if it's like Sean Anderson, prominent UK guy, he created this system, he's calling it agency or agentic or something like that. It's like a gazillion agents that do things based on a knowledge base that he gave them. He knows his stuff. He's been around for a long time. I would look into his stuff. I think what he does is probably something worth looking at. But this random person who slapped the expert title on their, they realized this was a thing like 2 months ago. Like, I don't know.
The tactic du jour. Final question. Is it worth it? A career in SEO. It kind of came up for me the other week of if I wanted to teach my daughter, who's 13, how to do search engine optimization, would I want her to follow a career path and become an SEO?
I wouldn't. I'm going to answer in a way that is not imposing a career on someone, because it really depends on who you are.
Yeah.
But it is a career that changes all the time, which for me makes it fun and not boring. But for some person, it might be terrible. It's a career that allows me to work from anywhere, just with good internet connection. And it allows me to just basically live however I want, because I am location dependent and I am somewhat time zone independent, because you don't have that many meetings with clients anyway. So you just have to deal with that thing. Like, I was in Australia for a very long time and I had US clients. So now and then I had an early meeting or a late meeting, and that's all the consequence that that had. Now I'm in South America and I'm in a US time zone. So that's all easy with my Australian clients. Europe is easy too. With my Australian clients, I only give them the morning, because that's the only overlap that we have. So they have less availability, but besides that, it doesn't really matter. So basically what I'm saying is it gives you a ton of flexibility. It keeps you entertained. And you just have to be a curious person that wants to figure out the truth constantly for it to be entertaining to you. If you're not that person, over time, you're going to lose relevance because the changes is maybe going to leave you behind.
A fantastic answer. Give a shout out to your company. Tell us what you've been working on, where people can find you online if they want to have more conversations about SEO.
Yeah, so the agency is structuralseo.com. It was born out of, I started managing agencies within that business, and then we worked with very prominent agencies, very big names that everyone would recognize, and they didn't deliver. We fired them. I asked for the project, took it on, and it worked well. So it was born out of, I can provide a better service than these guys. And if I can do it for this business, I can do it for other people. And that's the idea. We just want to help businesses make more money. If that's something that people want to do, if they want to diversify their source of income, which some people are over reliant on paid ads, they're sort of renting too much. They need to diversify a little bit. We can help you out. And if people want to find me, they can find me on LinkedIn. Just search for my name, Ernesto Ortiz. And if I don't show up and you put SEO, I'll surely show up. I've launched a new podcast on YouTube. You go Ernesto Ortiz SEO and it should show up. And yeah, if you want services or get in touch, just structuralseo.com and contact form and you'll get to me.
Well, thanks so much for the time and fascinating conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.